My name is Madassa Ahmed, Managing Partner at Unitas Communications, and this is PR Unmasked. In this episode, we will be discussing the Iranian protests and the future of democracy in Iran. Today, we're joined by historian and author Arash Azizi, by founder and executive director of the Bulbul Collective, Banafshe Madinejad, as well as Dr. Kamran Bukhari, director of analytical development at the New Lines Institute, and last but not least, journalist and author Nahid Siamdost. Thank you all for joining us.
Welcome, everyone. Panelists, thank you for joining us. I want to start off by asking, how did the recent protests in Iran start, and what is the current status right now? And I'll start with Banafshe.
Hi, everyone. Really glad to be here. Thank you, Madassa, for having us, for creating this panel, making it happen. So how did this all happen? A general state of discontent for 44 years. That's really the very short answer. I think that one major change about this particular uprising that I'm going to call a revolution, as opposed to the other uprisings, has been that we were hearing sort of whispers of, we don't want this regime anymore, we don't want Ali Khamenei as a supreme leader, starting in 2018. But this level of, we don't want the regime, we do not want reforms, we want this to end, and we're going to fight until the end to make it happen, is a very new thing. The impetus, the women's movement that's been going on for, it started literally less than a month after the 1979 revolution on March 8th, 1979, International Women's Day. Tens of thousands of women came out into the streets and they stayed for 5 days. And the only way that they got rid of the women was sending out thugs to scatter them away. So this women's movement has been going on since then. The women's movement was the spark. This is what has made it happen. And I'm going to open it up to other folks to add to it.
I suppose as a media scholar, for me, where I see this finally having boiled over is a situation in post-revolutionary Iran, especially over the last 10 years, where you've had a very active, vibrant, alternative public life that's been going on social media, on satellite television, and elsewhere, where Iranians have been very freely acting out the kinds of lives they imagine, the kinds of lives they would like to live. They've been putting these discourses out there, have been talking about the ways in which their lives are not the kinds of lives that they would like to live politically, socially, culturally, in terms of women's rights, in all kinds of ways, in terms of the opportunities they have economically in the world, their standing, their, you know, lack of dignity internally. And ultimately, I think with the Woman Life Freedom Movement, there was one moment before the arrest and killing of Mahsa Amini that I think is instrumental, which is the arrest of Sepide Rashno. She was on a bus. She saw this altercation between a woman who didn't have a headscarf on and a Sepah IRGC linked woman who was telling the other woman without the hijab to put it on. There was, you know, this fight that went on. Somebody recorded it. And ultimately, Sepide Rashno was the one who was apprehended and paraded a few weeks later on state television to apologize to the Revolutionary Guard associated woman. And it was this kind of humiliation of a young woman who, prior to the arrest, looked vibrant and on the parading on Sedar Sima on national television, appeared to have signs of some kind of torture, if not physical, certainly psychological torture. So there was this degradation of this woman paraded on state television, which wasn't the first time state television had done this, but this overpowering of, you know, the kind of life that ordinary Iranians have been living on social media and the imposition of this other life that really goes counter to the kind of everyday life that Iranians have been living for over, you know, for many decades, but certainly more openly, publicly in this alternative public sort of for over a decade. And this really came to a head finally with the arrest and killing of Mahsa Amini, the photos of her release. We don't know the extent to which she was beaten. Those details remain to be investigated and written. But what matters is that ultimately she died in morality police detention. For what? It's not even clear, because the photos that were released of her, she looked like an ordinary Iranian woman dressed in black, not too much, you know, she didn't look too showy. And if you can get killed for simply walking on the street, not abiding by very strict rules, or because, you know, some police or morality police person doesn't like the look on your face, then this could happen to anybody. And I think that's the point where these two worlds really clashed and collided and spilled over, the life Iranians have been living, yeah, and the the life that the state has been imposing on them.
Absolutely. So years of domestic repression bubbling up. But Kamran, do you think that there were also geopolitical reasons for the timing of this at the moment?
I think that there are, and I just want to add to what my colleagues have just said, and I totally agree with the antecedents that they've laid out. This has been brewing for a long time. There are multiple processes that were underway. There's the evolution of social media and the expression of that lifestyle that my colleague just mentioned. But there was also an evolution within the regime itself. And there are two levels of that. One is the sidelining of anybody who was openly reformist or pragmatic conservative and just bringing in very ideological people. It's what I call the intra-conservative elite feud. And we saw this from 2009 onwards in the Green Revolution. And then after that, you come to a point where even someone like Ahmadinejad is seen as not one of the core, if you will. So the core has shrunk, and obviously people are watching this. You know, people are looking at this inside Iran, and at some point, some trigger happens, and all those pent-up frustrations come out, and the sense that, look, this is probably the moment to actually push back and push back hard. Obviously, nobody can guarantee that the uprising will actually lead to the desired outcome, which is regime change, but at least people felt that this regime is now much, much more weaker. There are other processes. So, for example, the sanctions that were reimposed after the Trump administration nixed the nuclear deal. I mean, that really strained the situation. The Iranian regime had a hard time balancing the domestic political economy and the obligations on that front with their very assertive and aggressive foreign policy, especially over the last 10 years with Syria and also Yemen. So there are only so many resources, and if you're diverting them, that also causes frustration. People see that this regime cares more about what happens in Syria and Yemen and Iraq and Lebanon and even Afghanistan than what's happening inside. So all of these things shape a public perception. And they drive people to action. And that action happens when an event like this takes place, with the killing of Mahsa Amini. You see sort of the expression of outrage, all of that outrage that was building up come out. And I think that the regime realizes that it's on the defensive, and which is why it undertook its behavior since last August. And it's careful sort of calibration. Okay, what do we do here? And, do we crack down hard in this area or do we not? I mean, if you look at what's happening in Balochistan, in Zahedan, you have Maulvi Abdul Haq, every Friday speaking out, and the regime is not touching him, although he's actively challenging Khamenei. So all of these things are taking place and shaping this movement.
Yeah. Thank you. So, Arash, we've heard about some of the historical context, the bubbling up of frustration over 44 years, the individual brutality, and of course, some geopolitical considerations with overextension of budgets, but also with the narrowing of the ideological base. Would you like to add anything more to what's been said with regards to the context for how the current wave of protests have taken hold?
I agree with everything that my colleague said in helping to put this into context. What I would more specifically add is that people who are kind of really very important in this movement are people born in the late 90s and early 2000s. Banavsha pointed to their fearlessness, which I think is important. What I'll add here is this generation, and actually my generation, did everything it could to avoid wanting to have a revolution. This is sort of an interesting point, right? It tried every tool in the toolbox. Not only did the Iranians support a reform movement by voting for candidates who were entirely inside the regime, by trying to lay on some of their more sort of democratic tendencies. Not only they did that, and that opportunity was closed off, in the Rouhani era, they effectively supported candidates which didn't promise any democratic reform, right? Rouhani was not a reformist, didn't even promise any democratic reform. All he promised was two things that mattered. One was some sort of a citizenship rights, which is sort of distinct from democracy, right? So he basically tried to offer something that even Khomeini in the 1980s, at the height of the regime had sort of mauled after a while, by saying that, look, this regime is going to be a bit more legal and lawful. At least, you know, if you go to prison, you're going to go to prison based on some laws, not entirely arbitrary and not based into effectively extra legal organizations like the IRGC. That's the one thing he promised. And the other was reconciliation with the West, which was the main reason he won and the main reason a lot of people voted for him. And this reconciliation with the West, of course, is not some abstract, you know, sometimes when you read these foreign policy journals, it's like, you know, it's not some abstract thing. The Iranians wake up every day and they're like, you know, am I feeling more West-leaning today or not? It was tied directly to the Iranian economy and the livelihood issues. So this is why people voted for Rouhani. And he was blocked. And effectively, himself also didn't really do anything to pursue. He could have stood up his ground and said that he will defend what people voted for him. And of course, Trump's leaving of the Iran deal really complicated things for him, effectively ended his chance of wanting to follow what he had started with the Iran deal. But this all resulted in a perfect storm, if you will. So in the last few years, Iran has been a scene of almost constant protest. In fact, if you look at Iranian press, any day, I was telling a reporter recently this, and he sort of did a fun experiment. I said, you know, you pick any week between about 2017, 2018 till now, there is no week when there hasn't been some protest of some significance somewhere in our country. And of course, in 2021, by the fact that for the first time during my lifetime, effectively, presidential elections are non-competitive. It's important. They've never been free, but they've always, since 1997, been competitive, i.e. there are two wings that are actually competing in the ballot box with some credence. Whether you like it or not, people cared about the elections because they were genuinely competitive. They offered the way A and way B, which were different. For the first time, this wasn't the case in 2021. When I said Iranians did everything to avoid a revolution, the reason people would go and get shot and killed on the streets, despite the very long odds of them wanting to overcome the Islamic Republic, and despite the fact that, I hope we get to talk about it, the opposition has so far really not been able to put together a plausible long-term alternative. I think we are in the beginnings of it, and you know, I'm very hopeful that it could happen, but it certainly hadn't done so by September 2022. The reason people would go out and get killed to pursue these sort of revolutionary outcomes is that they found no other way. There was no way inside the system that they could do anything because, you know, economic opportunities are all closed.
Yeah.
Effectively, Iranians had two ways. Either leave the country, as many had done in droves,
yeah,
or rise up in revolt.
Thank you. Thank you, Arash. And I'd love to deconstruct that with you a little bit more later. But let's talk about the situation as it stands. So, Banavshi, if you will, can you tell our listeners about what the current situation, what's the current state of play regarding protests across the country?
Just a few days ago, there was a mass protest again. They are now not happening as often as they were in the beginning, but in some ways, this is the desirable outcome because that is not sustainable. So far, we have close to 20,000, mostly youth, put in political prison. And this is just since early September. More than 500 people killed. This is not sustainable. And we are literally at a point where there is no going back because we want the regime out. There is no confusion around this issue. But here's the thing. What is hopeful to me is all of the campaigns that are now going on inside Iran.
To bring you in, Dr. Naheed, on the current state of play, so talk to me a bit about the response of the regime. What is your view on dwindling numbers at protests?
I think the response of the regime has actually been interesting, and it tells us a little bit about how seriously they're taking what's happening. So initially, of course, they went all out at the killings and arrests that Banavshi pointed out, but also, you know, very targeted kind of brutal tactics like shooting out people's eyes from close range. And so you have these dozens, if not hundreds of young people missing one eye. But then it also started on the cultural front and on the political front, something that we hadn't really seen from the supreme leader previously in previous uprisings. He had never really taken a step toward protesters. But now we see the steps he's taken where some political prisoners have been released. He's been talking about creating potentially more inclusive environment. We haven't really seen this play out in any way politically that would be tangible or that would in any way satiate any demands that are going on. So that's kind of happening on the sidelines. But I don't think anybody's really taking that seriously or thinking that, okay, so maybe we can have reforms. So that's that boat has sailed, as you know, my colleagues have pointed out. That's no longer an option. So the response has been both brutal and at the same time, more recently on the cultural front and a little sort of political in terms of the prisoners trying to take some steps to ameliorate, like, you know, with the culture minister, the interior minister making statements about expatriates being allowed to come back in, artists being able to do more sort of daring acts, which everybody, you know, everybody has heard this for decades and people are not taking the bait. But the revolution itself has taken a really interesting trajectory where we now see, you know, after the battles on the streets, you know, have dissipated, now there's really organizational work happening where we've seen the charter from the labor unions and civic organizations of minimal demands, which, you know, is one of the most progressive charters I've ever seen anywhere. And if those demands were to be met, Iran would be one of the most progressive countries on earth, not just sort of, you know, in the region or elsewhere. So now we're seeing sort of this political work being done on the ground with the statements coming out of prison, Nagis Mohammadi and others, and then these charters from labor unions. And of course, we can talk about sort of the merit of some of the work that's also being done by expatriate opposition groups, especially sort of the one prominent one. But the real work has kind of started, I think.
Thank you, Naheed. Arash, I want to bring you in actually on the response.
To go back to what Naheed was saying, that I think is very important. The fact that from the phase of a street protest, we are moving to phase of, okay, let's get organized. Let's like, how does this actually work? You know, all my life, I have to say, sort of as a political activist, my biggest frustration has been the difficulty of getting people organized. And I think this has deep roots. I actually think it has global ideological roots. I think a lot of people have spread illusions, harmful illusions in hashtags, you know, in the belief that, well, no, kind of organization is so passe, you know, now you can sort of do hashtags and horizontalism, which I think is a particularly harmful idea that, you know, you don't need leaders. You know, I'm a sort of a classic socialist. I've always thought this was BS. And I think people really learn that if there are things in the world that you can do with horizontalism and without leaders and organizations, certainly overthrowing the Islamic Republic is not one of them. And I think people are really realizing this. The fact that 20 organizations inside Iran came together, mostly labor unions, feminist groups, student groups, and published this charter is important. Although, again, if one is going to be honest and one needs to be brutally honest in a revolution, I know all of these organizations, all their members and supporters put together, you know, are a few hundred, maybe a few thousand people. So one has to be sort of clear here. Right? Generously speaking, maybe there will be a few thousand people. So we are going a very long way to affect, bring change in the country of 80 million. We also had the Georgetown summit of eight opposition leaders abroad coming together, and they promised to publish the charter before the end of the month, which by my count is in 3 days. So, you know, we'll see where that goes. But that also was an unprecedented and important step. Although I have to say, it is a shame. Really, it is a shame that it took months of protests for this to happen. And the number one reason that the Islamic Republic has been able to live for as long as it has is the lack of an alternative. And the lack of alternative inside Iran is very explainable because as soon as people came together to do anything, they're suppressed. But we don't have much excuses for abroad. Millions of Iranians abroad, it is a historical failure that those of us abroad had failed to organize serious political organizations in the last few years.
What do you think is a realistic aim for the protesters right now?
Now that they're coming together, both abroad and inside, a formation of a political alternative is a game changer because it has an effect of the protest. What do protesters want? So you ask a question about whether there will be reforms that can placate the people. Sure. If the Khamenei and the regime are able to give significant reforms, of course people will be placated at least for a while. You know, no one actually likes the revolution, as I said. But even the most basic reforms would be, this is the poetry of a revolution, if you will. Khamenei has brought things to a point where admission of even the most basic reforms would need to be an admission that his entire life has been in vain, that he has failed to build the Islamic Republic, and that is something that he hasn't even done 5% of. So yes, if the Islamic Republic was to say that the hijab rule is gone, mandatory hijab is gone, if it was to say that the elections will be relatively free, even to a degree that they'll go to be as free as they were at some points, maybe that will have some effect. But he hasn't done anything like that. It's very hard to imagine him being able to do that without significant backlash, without things significantly changing. It's very hard to imagine that because of the corner that he has walked himself into. The ranks of the people, opponents of the regime, what they have to do is to get politically organized, and they're doing that. And the thing to remember here is, for a very long time now, it is no longer an issue of a people who has some problem with its government. This is usually the case. People really look at the regime with some justification as almost an occupying force, as a force that is totally alien to them. They use the most significant word in Persian political language is a basic word called ina, which means they. The way Iranians talk about the government as they, it's as if they, you know, they might as well have come from Mars.
Kamran, this is interesting. So the they have been very good at evading oil sanctions. We know that they have a fleet of ships that are evading oil and gas sanctions around the world. That they have developed a sophisticated political economy. You need hard cash to maintain the sort of control that they do. Talk to us, Kamran, a little bit about who's been filling the oil. I mean, we know that China and Russia has been quite active in economic dealings with Iran, but how are they managing to keep the show on the road economically, despite the best efforts of many countries and, of course, the sanctions?
Obviously, with difficulty. I mean, there is a reason why even a government like Raisi's is trying to push for some breakthrough on the talks. Mm-hmm. The idea is that we need the sanctions respite, and we need it badly. So they're taking it one day at a time, but this can't go on as it is because they can't assume, while they would like to believe, that, oh, you know, over time, these protests will get a handle on them. People will get tired, the exhaustion is setting in, and people will just wither away, and we would have dodged the bullet yet again. They can't assume that. They have to assume what worst case scenario, which is why they need far more resources to be able to throw at the problem. They don't have any ideas of how to fix it. As Arsh was saying, what is he going to do? Is he going to say, okay, you know, you don't need to wear the hijab anymore? That would just completely undermine everything and basically say, okay, whatever was happening for 40 some odd years was wrong. And you don't do that. This is an ideological regime and it faces a bigger existential crisis if it takes that. So the only way to deal with this situation is to say, okay, life can become better, because the calculus here is, look, guys, you don't like us. You know, you don't like this hijab. You want your freedoms and whatnot. You don't like the ideology. But you would be worse off if you overthrew us. Now, they don't have to convince everybody. They have to convince enough people that, look, if I go out on the street, if I get organized, then I'm going to be worse off. At the end of the day, I'm still getting all my needs fulfilled. There are jobs. The economy is working. That's why they need that sanctions respite. In the meantime, they're taking full advantage of the fact that Russia is mired into problems. And in exchange for drones and missiles and, you know, the Guards Corps offering advisors on how to fight, they're getting assistance from the Russians as well in terms of oil purchases, in terms of other forms of assistance, including technology. They're buying their time. I think that the big issue is what's going to happen when Khamenei is no more. Because at some point, he will die, and that would be a game changer. The next leader is not going to be like Khamenei. He will be a puppet of the guards. And this is already a very military-heavy state, particularly, you know, the Guards Corps. So I think that is probably the next opening, if you will, for people to be able to leverage. Now, they can't do it by themselves. They'll need help from within the regime. From the intelligence that I receive, there are guards who look at this far more pragmatically and say, look, we do all the heavy lifting, we do the sanctions busting, we do the oil smuggling, and why is it that all glory goes to the clerics? You know, across the Persian Gulf, our rivals in the Arab world are exporting oil and gas as if there's no tomorrow, and here we are sanctioned. And if we were able to be so resilient while being under sanctions, then guess what we could accomplish if we didn't have sanctions? So there is this tendency within, but there is no consensus just yet, at least not that I can make out, that says, okay, you know what? Let's do a deal. Let's be like China was in 1972, We're not going to be friends with the United States. We're not going to have relations, but at least we reach an understanding where we can actually get rid of some of these sanctions. We'll be good at home and we'll be able to provide for what the clerics have not been able to provide. So this is an opportunity from the guards' point of view to distance themselves from the clerics. It's hard, but it's something that could potentially happen, but it all depends on the timing of the transition in the Supreme Leadership.
Thanks, Kara. On the issue of sanctions, Dr. Benafsha, since you mentioned it, we had somebody from the audience ask, the issues with strangling the regime through sanctions is that you strangle the ordinary people of Iran. Would not lifting the sanctions, which would also benefit the regime, not help ordinary Iranians to connect with global markets and by extension empower ordinary folk? What's your view on that?
Obviously, if there were no sanctions, yes, people's lives would be better financially. There's no arguing with that. The issue is this. The people are up for this. They are asking us, this is what the people inside are asking us to do, to push for more targeted sanctions. Yes, that would be better. Sanction, which is what the MAFSA Act is doing. This is a bill that was reintroduced again in December, end of December, I think. Targeted sanctions are better. What is going on right now is that there's an argument about bringing JCPOA back, for instance. JCPOA, which was the Iran nuclear deal, was pulling back on the sanctions. But if it actually comes back, it will infuse more than $100 billion into the regime's coffers. This is problematic. This will literally give them the chance to ride this revolution out. So between those two choices of suffering inflation and strangling the regime, the people are choosing strangling the regime. It's a hard choice, but from what we're hearing from Iranians inside Iran, they are choosing strangling the regime. So they are asking for the JCPOA to not be reestablished.
Your thoughts on that, Dr. Tanahid, sanctions versus no sanctions?
I think it's a really tough question, to be honest. And I think, you know, what we hear from Iranians inside Iran can be quite varied on the question. I think most Iranians are absolutely 100% in favor of targeted sanctions against a Revolutionary Guard affiliated persons, against military, industrial military complex in Iran. But the question on the deal or not is a really tough one, as living conditions and standards are decreasing by the minute in Iran. And so I would like to sort of have an out on that question, to be honest, because I feel like there was a moment when this question was very pertinent, and that was during the Trump era, or a little bit before, when the deal was allowing for all kinds of openings in civil society and people who have enough to eat that they can actually deal with other matters. That point, I think, has ended. So this question, I feel that it's almost anachronistic. It is not the most pertinent question now, because things are in such a transitionary moment of flux where any Iranian on the ground, the people that I talk to, they themselves on that question, many of them will be very clear, like Benafsha said, and others are just really hurting. And they would like for any kind of support in order to really, you know, surpass the Islamic Republic.
Arash, I want to bring you in here on actually JCPOA. Your thoughts on what went wrong, and should there be another iteration? And if so, what would be the things to consider?
You know, I was, I think, like 16 when I started reporting on the nuclear talks. And here we are. I'm 35. We're still sort of reporting on it. So it's like a ghost that has carried me all my life. So look, here's what I think. Sanctions were a criminally stupid policy that have helped Khamenei and IRGC gain the power that they have. That's my beginning point. It's true that, you know, there were certain complications to this question, but overall, it's not hard to see that closing all ways of trade with Iran weakened the private sector, which was a base for a lot of middle-class opposition to the guards, and was the best news for the guards. And they worked very hard to achieve it in some ways. You know, there's a reason that the guards opposed the JCPOA when it was happening, the Iran talks when it was happening, as strongly as they did. Now, there were complications here. At the end of the day, it wouldn't have happened. JCPOA wouldn't have reached if Khamenei hadn't approved it. So this history can be complex and we can talk about it. But overall, it is, you know, it is my belief that sanctions were, as I said, criminally stupid, that they really helped the regime, nor have they ever worked anywhere sanctions as a whole that help destroy an entire country's infrastructure with the hope that you know, that will somehow change the behavior of the regime, they have hardly worked. It's a case of diminishing returns. For example, the United States had put these tough sanctions on Venezuela. Now it basically goes and tries to buy oil from Venezuela in order to lessen dependence on Russia, right? So that's what I think there. But we should also remember JCPOA had never anything to do with how democratic Iran was. If you are to be honest, also I should preface with something. This whole people in the Iran, I speak as an Iranian. I consider myself as legitimate as anybody Iranian outside or inside. I don't have this sort of, and Iran is 80 million people, so there's different takes on this, like on any other thing. I can only speak of what I believe is true. So JCPOA is now, I think, as others pointed out, it's sort of a dead issue. We should be very clear. It was never, ever at any point linked to human rights or democracy in Iran. We're just lying to ourselves if we say that, right? The only reason the world and the international community was angry with the United States was not how much they were killing us or not, was the nuclear issue. And unfortunately, a lot of Iranians actually are sort of have illusions about this. And it's the job of those who know to not pander to these illusions, but tell them the realities of the international affairs. Of course, if the regime comes with a significant offer on its nuclear front, of course they're going to take it, right? Like, who are we lying to? If the regime comes and says, hey, we're going to shut down the nuclear program entirely, we're going to go back to like 2014, of course it's going to gain some concessions. And why wouldn't it? At the end of the day, the West says all the right things about supporting the people and opposition to human rights and all that, but what it really cares about is the nuclear program. It also cares about some of the other regional behavior of the regime. I think those of us who are in favor of democracy in Iran, and I count myself amongst those who oppose the Islamic Republic, need to have a long-term strategy of organizing and preparing for those scenarios as well. Of the scenario that the Iranian regime will give certain concessions on the nuclear front and how to then fight in those conditions. We can advocate for certain policies at different points, but and you know, if the West wanted to make a deal with Iran over its nuclear program, we can protest and we can sort of go out and we can say things. But that really ultimately wouldn't matter. It would be internally illogical if the West was not to respond to a significant concession on the nuclear front with a change of things. Because currently, it is not saying Iran, hey, Iran, we're sanctioning you because you're putting people in jail. Yeah. It's not saying that, right? So I'll end. So the last thing I'd say, pointing to what Kamran said, that I think it's very important to remember, is that there is definitely the question of succession, right? What happens when Khamenei dies? And the question of guards or clerics is an important issue in Iran. And I've written about this, but there is certainly a section of the guards who are opposing Khamenei's type of policy. And they would like to see a change. And unfortunately, of those who, let's say, advocate a different policy for Iran, they have the higher chance now because they're closest to power and they're most organized. The job of the Iranian democratic opposition is to organize so that in that event also, it can actually rise up to them and continue advocating for democracy.
Thank you for that perspective, Kamran. Let's talk about the broader options for the West in this post-JCPOA, right? What are your thoughts on, of course, the Biden administration has other bigger priorities at the moment that it's focusing on, but how do you think it should address, if at all, what's happening on the ground? And are you seeing a big rethink of the way this whole issue is being proposed?
Yeah, I don't see a rethink. I think what's happening in Washington is a number of developments. One is, as you pointed out, they've got their hands full with the Ukraine war, with the China competition. Those are sort of like the signature issues. Then there is the question of politics. So, you know, you make policy, but then there's politics. 2024 is around the corner. There is less incentive for the Biden White House to cut a deal under the current circumstances, and especially after the protests, because one of the things that we're on which there's a bipartisan consensus is the way the regime has behaved after the protests and the brutal crushing of the demonstrators and just the sheer brutality with which the regime has behaved. There's no way that any administration can then, with a straight face, without losing political support, without empowering the Republicans, say, okay, you know what, let's do like a we're going to have negotiations and whatnot. Number three is the problem in the region. You have a new government in Israel with Bibi Netanyahu, and it's far more right-wing than it used to be. And we're seeing a lot of pressure come from that side. It's a very tense moment in U.S.-Israeli relations. So I think that that is another factor that has to be incorporated by the Biden White House to say, there's nothing compelling us to do a deal right now, but this thing could. And, you know, we need to be sure that the Israelis will not act on their own or do something that will upset our regional calculus. And that's where things stand right now. Unless there is some concession and a regime on the defensive is not going to concede anything. That would just be geopolitical suicide. So it's not going to do that. So I don't see any opening for a new deal until at least after 2024.
Thanks, Kamran. Banavshe, we could do an entire event on the role of religion in Iran. We're not going to. But I would love to hear your thoughts on whether you're finding religiously inspired rhetoric as part of the process, and whether there is a movement from the theologians and others to oppose the regime, is that beginning to happen?
Religiously inspired rhetoric in the beginning, very beginning of the revolution, I did see something interesting that was talking about Karbala and Imam Hussein and the fact that this regime is actually Yazid and the people are Hussein. That's about as far as it went. I do have to say, when I talk to Muslim friends, there is some confusion, not a lot actually, which is wonderful, but there is some confusion about whether there is some Islamophobia going on in Iran. The language that's being used, the slogans, the images that are being shown, especially the burning of the hijab in the very beginning, I think it alarmed a lot of Muslims. And if I were going to talk about religion in Iran, I would say this. I don't want to, there have been studies that say the level of religiosity is extremely low in Iran. I don't want to talk about that. Those are very murky and people's on the ground religions are hard to assess. In the face of such trauma done in the name of Islam. Although I do want to say one thing. One example of what this trauma is like is the following. About a couple of months ago, there was a tweet being circulated, and it was a letter from a woman in prison in the psychiatric ward. I'm just going to let people know this is going to be a little disturbing, so prepare yourselves. And she had written a letter to the warden, who himself is the chief of psychiatry, saying, I am asking you to not broadcast the azan because it's triggering me. And the reason why it's triggering me is because this is what my torturers and rapists did right before they raped me. So this is the level of, I don't even know what name to put on associates this association of rape and azan. It's diabolical. This is the level of, again, association between Islam and torture that the Iranian people have had to endure for all these years. And so if they are saying we don't want this, if they are saying we don't want religion, we don't want theocracy, even if they're saying we don't want Islam, this is the type of Islam they are talking about.
Naheed, can you maybe pick up on some of the points she was making, your reaction to her, so to speak?
I think, you know, what I've seen in my research and also in, you know, just years of following this is that what Banavshe referred to is correct. There certainly is a current and toward against religion that's been happening and against Islam because of this sort of, you know, very repressive form of dogmatic form of Islam that the state has imposed. But there's also been a very interesting other movement that's been happening where people, you know, there's still a lot of religious people in Iran who practice Islam, where they really actively distinguish their Islam from the state Islam that is imposed by the Islamic Republic. And that is definitely very vibrant as well. And I think that's interesting, you know, So this is really not a movement against Islam itself, I would say. It really is against state-imposed, dictatorial, corrupt Islam that the Islamic Republic imposes. And so what role does religion here play? Has it played a role in slogans? I think Banavshe referred to this. You know, I follow slogans and songs. And no, in fact, you know, the one thing that we do notice in songs and the protest slogans is that Islamic reference are missing. They were very prominent during the 2009 Green Uprising. because that really was a movement for reform from within. In fact, using very much this discourse of this competing, just, democratic Islam that could be harnessed to bring about change. That is no longer on the table. I think in part because people are trying to create a clean break and really signal that the next state, the next government they would like to have needs to be a secular one, needs to have a separation between Islam and politics, because the corruption of Islam is both bad for religion and for politics.
This is a fascinating discussion, but we're coming towards the end of it. And I'm sure there are lots of points that the panelists wanted to make, and there are lots of things that we've missed out. So I'm going to ask the panelists to offer their concluding remarks and share with us things that we ought to have be aware of. So I'll start with you, Arash.
I'll say this. I agree with what Banafsha said at the beginning. She started by saying this is a revolution. And I agree. This is a revolution. We are having a revolutionary moment of Iranians wanting to undo 1979 effectively in one way, get rid of this regime and strive for a goal that doesn't exist in our region. We have to be honest, right? There's no democracy. There's no liberal democracy of the kind that Iranians want. And they're very clear that that is what they want, by the way. They don't actually have disagreements on this. Unlike 1979, they're very clear. Now, some people like me are socialists and they have more socialist demands. But effectively, it's clear that everyone wants democracy. It's a very hard thing to do in our region. And this movement to overthrow the regime and wanting to replace it with democracy is something that has been going on, you know, all my life and has really reared its head now. Unfortunately, heroism doesn't achieve these results, right? And infatuation with heroism, it's great. You know, they're so brave. Bravery doesn't get you, unfortunately, the conclusions. In 2011, we had millions of people come out in the Arab world for the same goal. Every single one of them got crushed, with the exception of Tunisia, which only lasted again for some years before you had a coup and a change. These people weren't any less heroic, and they weren't any less brave. But unfortunately, they failed to build the necessary organizations and adopt the necessary strategy and tactics that could get them there. What I think, you know, I want the world to know about Iran, I want the sort of Iranians to know about each other and to do is to, we need to organize and we need to know that this is going to be a marathon. And the only way it would work, by the way, is through politics. You know, it doesn't work by sharing hashtags. It doesn't work by, you know, running actual marathons that some of our compatriots have done in the US. It doesn't do by sort of work. So it needs work of organized politics for years to come, and a dose of realism about, you know, what are the real conditions in our country at every moment, and to put together our differences. This is the second thing. We can pick to fight a person who has a bit of difference about future of Iran, or we can pick to unite against the regime. So far, the longevity of the regime is because of the divisions of Iranians who have opposed it. If we overcome that, we can change that. Or if no, we really decide that, no, our priority is to hate on people who did something we didn't like 10 years ago and all that, and that won't change. So that's the one thing. And the other thing I would say about the world is it is important to realize what I said about this regime being alien to Iranians. You can lie to yourself if you like. You can ignore all the science. You can ignore the particular brutalities and inhumanities unparalleled in the world that this regime has shown. There is no regime like the Islamic Republic on this planet. And, you know, I won't get to the details of it, but there are many reasons for this. You can close your eyes, or you can adopt a sort of a very serious tone of some sort of a, oh, I'm such a realist, you know, I'll let this happen. Things that have happened really in the 5, 10 years ago in relation to the regime. Or you can stand on the right side of the history and realize the kind of evil that really this regime represents, and realize that Iranians did stand up to it, did fight for it in the past few decades. They gave the ultimate price. That the Iranian cemeteries and prisons are filled with people who gave the ultimate price. And just because they didn't win yet, that doesn't mean that they, you know, their fight wasn't right.
Sure.
So yeah. I think this dualism is important as we go forward about Iranian future.
Thank you. Thank you. Kamran, closing thoughts, remarks?
I'm just going to say, look, it's evolutionary regime change that we're witnessing. And I think that the people have to latch on to whatever opening there is in the system and then take advantage of that. That's not to say that they should work within the system, because the system itself is coming apart. And I think that's going to be the opportunity. There's need to organize. And I think that's where the change will come, because at the end of the day, there isn't enough critical mass for, and there are divisions amongst Iranians, for them to be able to come together in a unified way and force the regime down. I think that the regime is weak, is dying, is decaying, but I don't think it's going to be able to, you know, come crashing down and then there'll be some, you know, ushering of in of democracy. It's going to be incremental. And I think the key is to work within the openings that are coming. And the next opening will be once there's going to be a new supreme leader and we're going to see the guards come up, there's going to be a lot of commotion. And I think that that is something to watch for, plan for, organize for, because at the end of the day, the guards are the ones that control telecommunications. They control the economy. And as long as they control that, it's difficult for anybody to come and organize. And you don't want a strategic vacuum in Iran. You don't want a collapse and then anarchy. You want to be able to come out on the other side where Iran is no longer the Islamic Republic. It's a much better place for Iranian people, because on one side you have the regime and the horrors that it has brought to the country. On the other is where nobody's in charge, and you don't want that either.
Dr. Ali, your closing thoughts.
I will be short and I will just echo Arash and, you know, the way in which we see how alien this regime is to Iran is, you know, by just reaching back, not even too far, but into its culture and poetry and the, you know, immense existence of art and tolerance and joy. And then on the ground more recently, just to look at these fierce feminists who have led not just this revolution, but most of the movements for civil rights and freedom and justice over the last few decades in the Islamic Republic that tries to target more than anything them and their bodies. I salute them. I'm in awe of them. I'm inspired by them. And basta siempre.
Badashe, over to you for the last word on this.
I echo what everybody has said. I do want to add one extra piece of information. I absolutely agree that organizing is number one right now, and putting aside differences and uniting around points of unity, absolutely the most important thing. But I also want to say it is happening. And I want to recognize this. The fact that these eight folks, and they are leaders, I see every single one of them as maybe not every single one, a couple of them maybe not, but the majority of them are leaders, especially the women. Especially Masih Alinejad. She's been at this for years. If I don't think this spark would have happened after Mahsa's murder if it weren't for her campaigns. I want to take a moment to recognize how far we have come. I want to celebrate our wins, what we have achieved. Yes, there is a long way to go. Nobody thinks maybe we did in the beginning think that it was going to happen, but now we understand we're in it for the long haul. And I think, yes, organizing at the state, in the United States, at the state level, then going to DC, doing lobbying, bringing information at this very moment, almost 190 Congress members have signed on to a bill, H.R. 100, that's basically suggesting the future regime for the Islamic Republic as the MEK, as Maryam Rajavi being the president-elect. That's frightening to me. This is a cult. And this tells us how much more work we need to do in the United States. I'm just talking about the U.S. here. So there's a lot of work for us to do, and we are organizing around this. Organizing is hard, and yes, we have not been organized, and that was a failure, but we're remedying that, and we are working on it. I just wanted to leave on that positive note.